Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that lie in the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening.
We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont.
Today we're going to have a different conversation. I want to take you back to the spring of 1985. There were two young men, each in all honesty probably as clueless about finance as the other. They were graduating from the London School of Economics that summer. Both were interviewing at Salomon Brothers, the muscular bond-trading US investment bank, bristling with ego, chutzpah, and on a mission to dominate global debt and equity trading. These two had made it through five rounds of ego-bruising interview combat. One was blonde, engaging, articulate, some would have described him as a preppy, an American who had added the LSE to Princeton, and he was very charming. The other was me, not blonde, possibly engaging, occasionally articulate, suppressing an ego based on not much more than hope and full of hot air, and not really clear what a bond actually was, but playing the game. Two candidates in the running and one place left on the fabled Salomon Brothers graduate training program. Well, I lost, and my guest today won. I joined Citibank, who then paid only half of the huge starting salary of Salomon Brothers. But the world won, because within 4 years, your blockbuster book was blasting through the charts, immediately iconic and remaining so today, 35 years later. There's only one Liar's Poker. So Michael Lewis, author, raconteur, investigator, podcaster, journalist, and visiting fellow at the University of California, Berkeley, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Simon, it's a delight to see you again. And there's so much wrong with that introduction that I don't even know where to begin. But in the first place, you frame it as the two of us enduring the same brutal meritocratic scrutiny. In fact, I went through none of those brutal rounds of interviewing at Salomon Brothers. I had dinner with the wife of the man who ran Salomon Brothers International. At the end of it, she said, "You must come work for my husband." So you were engaged in one form of capitalism, and I was engaged in another form of capitalism. And I never would have gotten through a round, much less five rounds.
Well, I'm really, really disappointed because it's made me seem somewhat brighter than I really was. But anyway.
And the punchline is the bank you went to join ended up acquiring the bank I went to join. Mine went out of business. It's pretty clear which bank had the bead on the talent.
Well, along with millions, I'm an unashamed fan and really appreciate you taking the time. But I'd just like to go back to the beginning because you were born in New Orleans, but I think you weren't the first Lewis to move there.
So the first Lewis, my ancestor, my father's great-great-great-great-grandfather, was Joshua Lewis, and he was sent by Thomas Jefferson. Some dispute about whether he was sent to receive the territory from the French or simply to be the first Chief Justice of the Louisiana Territory. But he was the first Chief Justice, and he wrote the first legal opinions. Joshua Lewis. And my family has been in New Orleans them since 1803, since then, on that side, and never left. My mother's side, who my father refers to as carpetbaggers, showed up in the 1840s. But this is going to sound strange. Maybe not to an Englishman, but to an American. A family that arrived in New Orleans in 1803 could still, when I was a kid, be viewed as arrivistes by the old French families. And I had a girlfriend in high school whose family had been there 100 years before mine, and we were the newcomers.
That's amazing. Now, how did New Orleans shape you or influence you for the future?
I would never have been able to answer that question while I was there, except it left me wholly unprepared for the American way of life. It wasn't a place that was defined by what you did. It was defined by who your mother was, who your father was, where you went to school, what neighborhood you lived in. Someone described it once not as the southernmost city in North America, but the northernmost city in South America. And there's really some truth to that. I mean, the only two really close relatives that I have who left both married Brazilian women. It left me at a weird angle to American life that has been useful. It didn't prepare me in this way, but it gave me a different view of the world than I think I might have had had I grown up in, you know, Cincinnati. And it also was a storytelling culture. It was an oral storytelling culture, but it moved slowly enough that it had time for story. And that probably was useful to me. I grew up listening to people who had an obligation to be entertaining when they opened their mouths. That's also a little different from the rest of the country. So it had some influence that way, but it was very indirect.
And you let slip, I read, that your mother said you made my life sheer hell. And I just wondered, how did you achieve that?
Someone's been doing their homework.
I know, I've got an important guest coming up.
Well, the context for that was, I was trying to, I think, alleviate a mother's concern that her son had made her life miserable for some period of time. And I thought back to my mother and I being at war from about the age of 9 to about the age of 15. And her turning to me one time in the kitchen. And what was so memorable about it wasn't in the heat of battle. It was in the course of a very calm conversation about something else. And she looked at me curiously and said, you know, for 7 years, you've made my life sheer hell. And I remember even in that moment thinking, yeah, I win. My mother is, though she's mellowed a bit, a real warrior. She was a really good athlete, very competitive. And she was something to push up against. I think that in my development, I did a lot of pushing up against her. Anybody watching it would think nothing but ill of me and nothing but well of her. I was a problematic child for a long stretch and expressed itself mainly this way. So I don't know how that leads to my career in any way or what I ended up being, but it was a formative period of life.
But one step in between, you go to Princeton and then you go to the LSE. And at the time, the LSE had over 40% overseas students, and it was dubbed Let's See Europe. But I wonder what it was that you took from the LSE.
We met at the LSE. My first impression of the LSE coming from Princeton, and this is 1983, was how impoverished it was. I couldn't believe how starved of resources it was. But this was true of the whole of England in that moment. People used to say of Princeton that getting an education at Princeton was like trying to get a drink of water from a fire hose, that there was so much coming at you, so many resources being thrown at you. You were overwhelmed by it in a good way. When I got to the LSE, I realized that getting an education here is going to be like getting a drink of water from a drinking fountain, where you have to push the button really hard and put your mouth really close to the spigot because it's not coming out thick and fast. And when I realized that, it was actually a wonderful experience. I had really good teachers. Mervyn King, governor of the Bank of England, was my teacher. Morris Perlman was a wonderful economist who took me on and kicked my mind into gear. But it was broader than that. It was being thrown into a completely alien environment and learning how to flourish. I loved it at the end. And London was, of course, fabulous. One of the most memorable things about that stretch was because the year before we got there, the Student Athletic Union had squandered the entire 100,000-pound athletic budget on a racehorse, and it had become a national scandal. It was in the newspapers, and the horse wasn't even any good. That when we got there, there was pretty strict controls over where the athletic money went. There weren't many teams, and we had a basketball team. And because we had a real basketball team with LSE on the front of it, we were supplied with unbelievable resources. While the school itself seemed down at the heels, we were put up in bed and breakfasts around Europe to play basketball games. that was a total gas. I mean, a really memorable part of the thing. And I guess the last thing it did for me was, I mean, I'd come from being an art history major in college, and I had very self-consciously gone out to study economics because I'd realized this was a language I would maybe need to speak if I was going to move through the world. The world felt like a conspiracy of people who understood this language. And it did teach me the language, and it led to me ending up on a Wall Street trading floor, which ended up with me writing Liar's Poker.
That's great, because that takes us to the Salomon Brothers juncture. I mean, I knew going back that I was trying to blag my way into a job for I wasn't qualified, but you have said that you were a fraud joining them. Why was that?
I didn't know or care. You at least probably cared. I mean, we were all frauds. Everybody should have felt imposter syndrome, and only the idiots didn't. I mean, once you got in, you realized the business had changed so much so fast that even the people who were running the business didn't completely understand the business. There was no one who was going to teach you this before you got there. What was going on a trading floor on any given day? This is all stuff you had to learn on the job. But I felt maybe more fraudulent than you because I knew I wanted to write for a living at that point. While I was at LSE, I started to publish magazine pieces. The Economist gave me my start. They didn't have my name on them, but I published a dozen pieces in The Economist my second year at the LSE. I was really a stringer for them, for all over the paper. But they paid £90 a piece, which you couldn't live on. A piece might take you a month to do. I just couldn't see a way to make a living at it. So when I went into Salomon Brothers, I went in knowing, well, I'm going to make some money here, maybe have an adventure that will be interesting to write about one day. But I didn't go in thinking, I'm going to have a career in finance. It was, how long can I last? Which turned out to be not very long. I went in under false pretenses.
Well, the Economists were paying you £90. I had a job as a waiter at the Grosvenor House for that time, and I think that I would have been lucky to get 1/9 of that for my endeavors.
Per day, though, right?
An evening at the Grosvenor House, and you hope that you're going to make some money out of the tips. But actually, I want to recount a story to you, Michael, before we get into lots of other things. But you were on the Salomon training program with our mutual friend, Ravi Joseph. He's had a very successful career at Goldman's and Morgan Stanley as founder and CEO of Mount Street Capital. But Ravi told me the story, which you may or may not have heard, is that he was assigned to the mortgage bond traders. And as you've documented in your book, many of them were of Italian origin. They were larger than life. They were ebullient. And one day, Ravi arrived and he was taken aside by one of the senior mortgage traders who had a conversation that went something like, "Now, Ravi, today, Tony Barola, one of our older traders, is going to come in and he's going abroad on holiday to Puerto Rico. And he's going to bring his suitcase in and he's going to put it in the cupboard by the toilets. And I want you and Joey, when he goes off to get a bagel at about 11 o'clock, to take the suitcase, to take it into the toilets, take out all his clothes and fill it with wet towels." Ravi and Joey did that. And Tony Barola went to Puerto Rico. And apparently the next morning at 6:30, the one internal trading line was flashing and they knew it wasn't the client. They knew who it was. And when somebody eventually answered, this bond trader turned potential murderer said something like, "When I'm back in New York, I'm going to get that bastard."
That story was typical in many ways. One, it tells you many things. How much time people had on their hands. Different world. Two, that everybody knew, get the new kid at the desk to do it so you weren't the one who got killed. The joy of the place was that people didn't forget to have fun. I think when you walk into a big hedge fund right now, or you walk onto the trading floor of a big bank, it's completely silent now. There's hardly any interactions. People staring at screens and you hear clicking. There was so much human interaction just in the business at that time. You were constantly shouting at the person next to you or across the desk from you or down the row from you, that it just naturally led other kinds of interaction. You knew your neighbor. You don't know your neighbor anymore. Had that not been true, I think it would have been very hard for me to write a book about it. What drove the whole thing was these human interactions, and that's been bled from the business.
But thinking that you're going to be an author is one thing, but what took place that made you absolutely clear that this was your first story?
It really wasn't that hard. What happened was I continued to write while I was there. The natural thing to do is write roughly about what I'm doing all day. It starts with this. I get published in the Wall Street Journal, the op-ed page, a long piece arguing that bankers are overpaid. And at the bottom, it says I'm an associate at Salomon Brothers in London. This causes the roof to fall on me. I end up being taken aside by the guy who hired me, the guy who ran Solomon Brothers International, and he says, you can't do this. Actually, he was on the phone with the board of directors all night trying to figure out what to do to suppress this thing because it looked so bad. I said I wasn't going to stop writing, but he's asked if I do it under another name. And I ended up doing it under my mother's maiden name, Diana Bleeker. So then I felt this liberty, like no one's going to know it's me. I can write about what I want to write about. Well, I did not put Solomon Brothers in it directly. I was describing scenes in magazines. I didn't do much of it, but I did like half a dozen of these things over a year and a half period. And every time I published one of these things, it would be mimeographed and distributed across the Solomon London trading floor. And I would see everybody reading it. I didn't think of it this way, but it was market testing. It was like, if I write about this, people will read about this. The very people who I'm more or less writing about. So I knew that there was a market and I really enjoyed doing it. And I had the sense that this thing was happening on Wall Street that was a really important thing. And outside of Wall Street had only the most partial view of what was going on. It was an arbitrage at an informational edge. One day, I get back to my house in Hampstead and the phone rings and it's an editor from a publisher from Simon & Schuster who happens to be the father of the actor Chevy Chase. His name is Ned Chase and he's a very senior editor at Simon & Schuster. And he's figured out who Diana Bleeker, my mother's maiden name, is. He's figured out it's me. And he's called to offer me a book contract. At that moment, I thought, I can make a living, I'm out of here. And that was 2.5 years into it. I hung around for another few months to get my bonus. And then I was out. There's a funny moment. This will give you a sense of the spirit of it all. Because though it was kind of sneaky, it wasn't as sneaky as all that. In that I told them when I was leaving that I was going to go write a book about Wall Street. I didn't exactly know what it was going to look like. In fact, I kind of thought it was a more antiseptic history that led up to this thing. But they take me into a room. They don't take me into a room to tell me, you can't do this. You signed a non-disclosure agreement. Everything you saw here, you need to forget. None of that. They don't even care about it. They take me into a room because they understand that I'm getting a $40,000 advance to write this book, and they just paid me $250,000. And they're thinking they're going to pay me twice that the next year. And they're actually worried about my mental health. We really like you. We're really worried about you. Can we just talk you down from this ledge? Because really, it's a mistake. Just for your own sake, have a good career. Go make a lot of money. Don't go blow it by trying to write some book, which will never happen. Actually, it was touching. They were really worried about me when I walked out. I was kind of moved by it. It was very sweet of them because they were probably in some sense right. I probably shouldn't have done it, but it all worked out.
You couldn't make it up. Now, you've written, I think, at least 16 books. Three of them are films. You've been a New York Times bestselling author multiple times. What inspires you to write a book?
At the end of every book, I tell myself, pretend you're done. This is it. You don't have an obligation to write another one because you don't want to do it out of a sense of obligation because it's just what you're supposed to do. You want to do it because something so special walks in, you can't not write a book. So I try to start in that frame of mind. I'm no longer an author. Something really has to present itself for me to really want to do it. Of course, this is a little bit of a conceit. And at some point, I remember I'm an author and I go write a book. But what has to happen, a couple things have to happen. Almost always, in retrospect, starts with a character. But sometimes I don't find the character, but for a question. Why are the Oakland A's winning so many games with no money? That led me to Billy Beane, but it starts with a question. How did all these Wall Street firms filled with all these smart people blow themselves up? Starts with a question, but ends with these people who had shorted the market and been on the right side of the bet against the Wall Street firms, who were just wonderful characters. Without a character that I care about and that I think I can really make swing on the page, I certainly don't have a book because I don't write that kind of book. I don't write long arguments. They're narratives. So character is the primary ingredient. And then after that, it's a feeling that this subject is, for some reason, really important. And it may be delusional, but I've certainly talked myself into it. The last thing, this is a Wall Street thing. This has not left me. I always ask myself, why do I have this story? When someone presents you with a trade that seems too good, like, all right, if it's so great, why do I have the opportunity to do it? Why haven't 6,000 people before me done it? What is it that's giving me some sort of privileged access to this thing? I kind of have to figure that out before I'm convinced that I should be doing it because I don't think the market's that inefficient. I think that it's a little inefficient. So that question's oddly gotten a little easier to answer because sometimes the answer is they'll just let me in and they won't let anybody else in. I have to feel like I have an obligation, because if I don't do it, it won't get done and it needs to get done. When I have that feeling, I'm on my way.
That leads us right into your new book, Premonition, A Pandemic Story. I bought it on Kindle. I started reading it. I got increasingly drawn into the unfolding drama and didn't think I was going to be able to finish it in time for the interview, but I did. And you say in the introduction, I like to think my job is mainly to find the story in the material. And in this case, what did you discover?
To answer that question, I have to back up a little bit. The previous book before The Premonition had been called The Fifth Risk. And it was really a series of magazine pieces that were just linked together, but they were so close in theme that they worked as a book. It was me asking the question, what happens when Americans so misunderstand their government, so neglect their government, that they don't even see all these risk management functions it serves? And they allow a president to completely neglect those functions. Because among other things, a federal government is a manager of a portfolio of pretty serious risks, whether it's climate risk or food safety or security of the grid or risk of nuclear weapons going off or risk of a pandemic. And it was pretty clear that we'd gotten to a situation in this country where we had let this tool for managing risk ossify, decay. And I was saying, I don't know what's going to happen, but something's going to happen. So what happens? The pandemic happens. And the first thing I discover, and it's not me, it's the characters I find. So the first thing I discover is these characters, and they're unbelievable characters. It's essentially doctors. It's a book about the doctor's approach to the pandemic. And the doctors are placed in different parts of the system. One of them is a really on-the-ground battlefield command-type local health officer who's been dealing with disease outbreaks her whole career, and you just haven't seen him because you don't think about multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis or measles or HIV, but these are, in some cases, life and death things she's doing, and she's mucking around in the community and social distancing people and doing things that make her unpopular, but she's actually saving lives. There's that person. They're the people who wrote the pandemic plan for the United States during the Bush administration, some doctors who were just brought in to think about the problem and who thought about it very originally. Then there's this almost science fiction character, Virus Hunter, who's at University of California, San Francisco, who is at the bleeding edge of using genomic information to hunt viruses, who was at the moment of the beginning of the pandemic in the process of using Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates's money to try to build a system of global tripwires to tell us when some new pathogen had leapt from animals into people. And these characters all interact, just magic. It kind of happened as I was working on it, but they all have things to do with each other. What they teach me and teach the reader is the same stuff that the characters in The Big Short teach the reader. They're people inside of a broken system who understand the system better than the system does understand itself, whose experience in the system lead us to some insights about where the system is broken and why. And the first thing that kind of surprised me, it shouldn't have, what kind of surprised me was that the Centers for Disease Control, which had a gold-plated reputation going into the pandemic, if you'd asked me which of the federal agencies has the capacity to withstand some horrible event, I would have picked them maybe at the top. Even they, their authority, their guts, their nerve, their willingness to actually do their jobs in the face of lots of controversy had been undermined. And the characters in the book actually know this going into the pandemic. And if you know their experience, you kind of know what's going to happen. But you had to be really in the weeds in the system to see it beforehand. Mainly with the book, this is going to sound odd given what a grim subject it is. It was a total joy to write. I wonder if you're reading it, you can see this. How much fun these characters might have been to write. They're so extreme. They're so unusual. It's the closest thing I've had as a writer to the experience where you're just a conduit for the story. Just get out of the way of this thing. What's coming at you is so good. It was totally fun to write. And I think it was fun to write because whenever you're dealing with passionate, informed people who understand the world better than the world understands itself, but they're having trouble getting their message across, you've got all the ingredients of something that's going to just light up a page. And the biggest thing I discovered with these people, that they existed. I mean, I had no idea, and I suspect no one else in my country did either, that George Bush, back in 2006, asked his people, like, what's the plan for a pandemic? And they said, well, we don't have one. And then he brought in these doctors, these two doctors, from the ground up, really thought about, investigated what had happened back in 1918, made arguments to the public health community about what could be done, actually reconceived what you would do in the very beginning of a pandemic. I didn't know any of this history. So the people in the middle of the book were the greatest discovery. The various dysfunctions, the specific problems in the system and what caused them, that's another order of discovery.
So I will recount one vivid moment, because hopefully our listeners will be going out to download and buy that book. But when the health expert you talked about has to examine this dead corpse that's had tuberculosis and has to use garden shears because she's not getting any help, it was vivid and stayed with me for a little while.
This is the opening scene of the book, but she's the local health officer of Santa Barbara County. She's been told that there is a corpse in the morgue that has died of tuberculosis. It's multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis. She needs to know where the tuberculosis is in the lungs, because it doesn't spread unless it's in the lungs, and it can appear in lots of different parts of the body. So she needs to get some lung tissue. And the coroner won't let her because he's got this study that shows how dangerous it is to open up a body with tuberculosis. Now, she thinks this is a bullshit study and there's only one of them, and she's going to do it herself. It was the male ruling order in Santa Barbara County. The sheriff, the coroner, deputies all thought, if we don't do it, she won't do it. It just won't happen. And she insists on, it's like day after Christmas or the day before Christmas, I can't remember which, but she's coming from her Christmas tree. She says, okay, just leave the body out and I'll take care of it. And she gets there and they're all standing around. These guys are all standing around in hazmat suits. She's in like a blouse and jeans. And the coroner has not even bothered to show up with the tools to open a body. All he's got is a pair of garden shears. And he thinks it's a big joke. Like, oh, this isn't going to happen. And she gets up on top of the body and takes the garden shears and cuts the front of her body open and grabs the lung and yanks it out. I mean, they didn't know who they were dealing with. It was a way of establishing who they were dealing with. It was also this way of establishing, and this was the tell, how brave you had to be, and she had to be over and over as a local public health officer just to do her job. The system really didn't respect this character. And because we drifted far enough away from communicable disease being a widespread threat to people, that it wasn't top of mind for most people, that this person who controlled communicable disease became lower and lower status. And she had to assert herself in all kinds of crazy ways. Her life, this is not just her, these are local public health officers around the country here. It reads like a television show. When I learned how she led her life, I couldn't believe no one had moved in with cameras to capture this. That fact alone told you that if something bad really happens in this country, we have not empowered the people who actually might control it and explain it to us and lead us. They're not in leadership positions. They don't have the power to do anything about it. And she had told you that too.
There are some memorable quotations. Some will remember them. Trump first said, it's one person coming from China and we have it under control. And then later, it's like a miracle, it's going to disappear. But then you quote the medical professor at Stanford who said the virus posed no real threat. So as you put this story together, could it have been different under a different political administration? Or was it just that the system is structurally flawed?
It was going to be bad in any case here. It didn't have to be nearly as bad as it was. When I wrote the book, right up to the moment of the vaccine appearing on the scene, there was this astonishing statistic that the United States had only a bit more than 4% of the world's population and more than 20% of the world's deaths. Going into the pandemic, well, before the pandemic, October of 2019, there had been this very elaborate study done with millions of dollars and hundreds of experts and lots of research that had taken a couple of years by an outfit in Washington called the Nuclear Threat Initiative. And they had, coincidentally, set out to ask the question, how well prepared are various nations for a pandemic? And they ranked everybody. And they ranked us first and you second. The United States first and the United Kingdom second. And if you look at the outcomes, it's breathtaking, given how we were supposed to perform, how badly we performed. Even if you say, okay, it's not fair to compare the United States to South Korea or Japan or some other society where people actually obey their government, or China, where they lock everybody in the rooms. If you compare the United States, as The Lancet did a little more than a year ago now, to just the other G7 countries. At that point, they calculated that if we'd just done as well as the other G7 countries, we'd have 150,000 people alive who are not alive. The point is that our response was really bad. How much better would it have been if someone else had been in power who was willing to not use it as a way to divide the country, but to unite the country? Better. Hard to know how much better, because as the characters all show you, the enterprise that was meant to run the pandemic, the Centers for Disease Control, had been pretty badly undermined in its willingness to actually run the battlefield during a battle. What had happened was they'd been politicized going way back to the 1980s. The person running the place had ceased to be a career civil servant and became a presidential appointee, and a lot of things followed from that. Basically, the big thing that followed from that was that the cost of any kind of controversy had gone up. At the same time, there had been no real existential risk to the country for a long time. What the CDC did in response was sort of retreat and become more of an academic institution. As Charity Dean says, CDC should be renamed. It should be called the Centers for Disease Observation and Reporting, because they don't control disease. They don't even try. So we had essentially an academic institution that felt it needed to wait for complete certainty before it acted. That's simply not the nature of pandemic control. You have to be way out in front of it and explaining to people why you're doing weird stuff when there doesn't seem to be any threat. Like why you're putting plywood over windows when there's a blue sky because a hurricane's coming. You need to kind of lead that way. And they really weren't equipped to lead that way. It wouldn't have been great. I think that it would have been better. And someone down the road will try to figure out how many lives Trump cost us, but he cost us some.
Before we leave this topic, was that one statistic that they were testing in Zimbabwe before they were in California?
They were testing in Zimbabwe before they were in California. And this is, to me, the anecdote that just leaps off the page, is when we repatriated Americans from Wuhan in early March, late February, whenever it was, maybe it was even a little before that, to National Guard facilities in California and in Omaha, Nebraska. And a doctor who's in the book named James Lawler, who runs a federal medical enterprise in Omaha, Nebraska, wanted to test the 80-something people who'd come from Wuhan for COVID. Now, this seems like a pretty natural thing to do. They've just come from Wuhan. You've extracted them because you're afraid they have COVID. The CDC wouldn't test them. The request goes all the way up to the director of the CDC, who sends a note saying, I forbid you to test them because testing them would be performing medical experiments on imprisoned persons. Now, all these people wanted to be tested. It was as if they behaved as if they did not want to find COVID. Instead, they tried not to find it. Why that is, I'll leave to other people to speculate, but that created all kinds of problems.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. We've got lots more to come. But a quick word on our new sponsor. Last year, I interviewed Gary Boom, CEO of Bordeaux Index. Wine is a great love of mine. And as he explained, Bordeaux Index has become a major disruptor in the way that wine is bought and sold and has sought to redefine the way a wine merchant works. I've been really impressed with their business and have been buying wine from them since that interview. So we're delighted that the Money Maze podcast is now also sponsored by LiveTrade, their world-leading fine wine trading platform. LiveTrade has changed the way fine wine is bought and sold worldwide. You can instantly buy and sell or place bids and offers on key wines from Bordeaux, Champagne, Italy, and other world regions. Their two-way pricing offers guaranteed trading liquidity with no fees. So I recommend you have a look at their website, bordeauxindex.com/LiveTrade. So let's tilt left or right. John Mason is a good friend of mine and later was Salomon Brothers head of European equity, wrote me a note when he knew I was interviewing you and said his brilliance is in taking big global issues and reducing them to an individual lived experience. And I thought that was a really nice encapsulation. But what do you think your strongest skill as a writer is?
That's a very nice way of putting what I would have said, what I do. I do think that my job is to find people through whom I can tell the stories I want to tell. What I'm looking for is not just great characters on the page, but teachers, people who can teach me and my reader. And I think that I'm good at finding those people. It requires lots of trial and error, but I think I'm good at finding those people and building relationships with them that enable me to get sufficiently far into their lives that I can bring them to life on the page. If I told you up front that you, Simon, you were going to be my next subject, and I told you what it was going to involve, before I even finished, you'd be out the door so fast and down the road, and I'd never see you again. It is such a pain in the ass for my subjects to enable me to do what I do. If you said, what edge do you have? One edge I have is for whatever reason, I'm able to slowly persuade people to commit to do something that they never would commit to up front. A bit like selling bonds at Salomon Brothers. getting into their lives slowly, turning my characters into frogs in boiling water, persuading them to cooperate with this enterprise. It's always hard, but I can't do it without their cooperation. As time has gone on, I've tended to become more and more of a pain in the ass. I've tended to want more and more from these subjects, so much that I wouldn't dare tell them what I require up front, but have some ability, once I'm in a relationship with them, to lead them to where we need to go.
I want to turn to your book, The Undoing Project, which some have said may well be your best book, How a Nobel Prize-winning Theory of the Mind Altered Our Perception of Reality. And you can just tell me, these two professors, Kahneman and Tversky, you say are more responsible than anybody for the powerful trend to mistrust human intuition and defer to algorithms. Now, were you screening Nobel Prize winners for an idea for a new book?
This is a really good example of how haphazardly my book subjects come at me. What happened was this. I'd published this book, Moneyball, that was about this professional baseball team finding that the market misvalued professional baseball players, using better data to find the mistakes the markets made about players. And the mistakes were as crude as not seeing the value of a player who just didn't look right in some way because he was not shaped like a baseball player. He was really good at baseball, but just his physical appearance deceived people sufficiently that they could get that player cheaply. So this baseball team has already in its mind classified the mistakes that scouts using their intuitive judgments are making. And they have a whole list of them. It's like things that are really vivid, like foot speed or power. These are not going to go missed. But virtues that are really subtle, like an ability to see a ball coming at you 100 miles an hour and see whether it's 1 inch off the plate or 1 inch on the plate. These things might be missed. But they say they've done this, and I've written a book about them. The book comes out, and it gets reviewed by Richard Thaler, who would go on to win the Nobel Prize in Economics, and Cass Sunstein, who's his writing partner and is a law professor at Harvard. They review the book, and they say, Michael Lewis, in this book, has failed to understand his own story. What it really is, they say, is a case study demonstrating the power of the work of Amos Tversky and Danny Kahneman, two Israeli psychologists. And I'd never heard of Amos Tversky or Danny Kahneman. I thought, who are these people? And it turned out that Kahneman Tversky had done this work back in the 70s and 1980s to show the way human decision-making was warped by intuition and that the way our intuition misled us. And they had indeed basically anticipated what was going to happen in the market for baseball players. So I got interested in them for that reason. I wouldn't have written a book about them if that was all there was to them because I'd already written Moneyball. I got attracted to writing about them, one, because it turned out I had personal introductions to both sides of the collaboration. Amos Tversky was dead, but I knew his family. It just turned out. I taught his son without knowing I taught his son. And Danny Kahneman, the other side of the collaboration, lived a mile up the hill from me in Berkeley and was friends of friends. So I started talking to Danny Kahneman, and it became clear that not only was this work they'd done together of world historic importance. Their work, among the other things it spins out, is behavioral economics. They are the origin of behavioral economics. Not only was the work really important and interesting, but their relationship was this platonic love story that was more intense than any romantic love story that I'd ever read. I had a love story to write that was a story of collaboration that had all of this intellectual consequence. And it was all done against the backdrop of the war and drama of the early days of the Israeli state. It was a challenging book to write for one reason. It was the only time I've had up to this point where I felt like I quite possibly couldn't get my mind around my characters' minds because their minds were so big that I was only going to be able to partially envelop them as opposed to what I usually do, totally envelop them. I felt like the B student who was all of a sudden assigned to describe the A students. I've been spending my life describing C and B students, the people in finance and in sports. But these people were just a different order of intellect. So I was a little intimidated by the subject, but the material was so good. And to this day, it amazes me that no one has seized the book and made a film of it. It seems like a quiet story. It seems like a story of intellectual life. It is such a dramatic story. Emotionally, physically, it's just a dramatic story. Anyway, I love writing it. It grew very naturally out of stuff that I'd already written.
Well, by curious coincidence, I'm interviewing next week Bridgewater's chief investment officer, a lady called Karen Carneal Tambour, and I was listening to some other interviews that she'd done, and she refers to your book, and she says it is a fantastic example of how you can get people and institutions to work better together. So I guess my question is, what are the lessons that organizations and individuals should draw from their discoveries?
The first lesson they should draw is not from their discoveries, but from their actual collaboration. Neither of them do work on their own that is as powerful as the work they do together. No one ever sees them working together. They go in a room, they close the door, and all anybody hears is laughter coming from inside the room. They're just shooting the shit, and they're just talking, and it's just going places. Why is it going places? It's going places, Danny explains, because Amos Tversky, who everybody at that moment regards as the smartest man they've ever met. Every person I talked to about him said he was the smartest man I ever met. One guy, a guy named Dick Nisbet, a sociologist at Michigan, devised an intelligence test, which he said was the shortest intelligence test ever devised. It was, after you meet Amos Tversky, the longer it takes for you to figure out he's smarter than you, the stupider you are. And he's immensely critical. Everybody's afraid of him. He's the kind of person that if you say something stupid, he lets you know. But with Danny, he lets his guard down. They close the door and they start laughing. And Danny says the key to the whole relationship was that whatever it was in Amos that caused him to prevent half-formed ideas, other people's stupidities, all the rest from entering his mind, he let it go. And we just built a relationship the way two improv comedians would. Amos didn't say, "That's wrong, Danny," when Danny said something. Amos would say, "Let me think about what that's right about." The first lesson in the book is the power of collaboration. And a corollary to that lesson is how unbelievably difficult people find it to see the power. When a collaboration generates magical stuff, this is a story of academia, but I think it's true outside of academia too. The outside world instantly goes to pick apart who did what. Lennon and McCartney, who actually did it? You get this over and over. Gilbert and Sullivan, over and over. Who was the actual genius? And the truth is, there is none. There's something that two people can do together that one person can't do alone, and that should just be respected in and of itself as a thing. And this is one of the great collaborations in human history. And it's kind of magical because they're such an odd couple. They're so different from each other. It shows you the magic of what can happen when two people just open each other up to each other. It also shows you how hostile the world is to it. Ends up kind of tearing apart their collaboration by insisting that Amos is responsible for all of it when he wasn't. It ends up eating at the thing. So that's the very first thing, the power of collaboration and encouraging that collaboration, and then not trying to disentangle it after it produces magical stuff. The lessons of the work, if you ask me to describe what they did in a few sentences, it's that they showed that people, when they move through the world, are not probabilistic thinkers. They are not calculating the odds of this or that happening, even when the odds can be calculated. They're thinking in stories, and the stories have predictable patterns to them, and those patterns will distort your judgment. It was the classification of the distortions that they did so well that you kind of have to read about it to get it all. But how your mind might mislead you is a really useful thing to know. Now, Danny would say, even when you know it, you can't do much about it. But I would say that if you're going to do anything about it, you at least got to know about it. All is not futile.
But when you looked at that and you looked at the use of data and you go back to Moneyball, do you actually think that when you translate that into investors and investor behavior, that there are quite a lot of similarities, by which I mean people's willingness to hook on to stocks that have got a story and don't worry about the valuation, and that might leave behind a whole section of the market that some might dub as value, but suddenly at some point in time, they do care about it.
There are so many other people who spent so much time thinking about this in the markets, who is so much better equipped than I am to talk about how this actually might be useful to an investor. And there was a lot written about it at the time when the book came out. Also a lot written about Moneyball at the time, that what was going on in the market for baseball players happened in the market for stocks. I tend to think that the market, at least for stocks, it's harder to beat than the market for baseball players was. Put it this way, there are not a lot of people who I know of who've gotten rich with funds, where they have set out with a kind of rule-based approach using Kahneman Tversky-like thinking to beat the market. Someone came to me and said, "Here, Michael, put some money into this fund. We're going to use what Danny and Amos understood to go bet on stocks." I would say, no, thank you. I think it's harder than that. It's like in your life, the kind of judgments you wind up making as you're moving through the day. Your life is enriched knowing these things your mind is doing. That's not to say that your next guest, who actually maybe knows about the markets in ways I don't, and is actually in the markets in ways I'm not, doesn't have something to say about this is really useful. It may be that I just don't know about it. I'm just a little wary of it.
You are a very successful podcaster, but I have to ask you, why did you want to start a podcast?
There's so many different kinds of podcasts. It's odd they're all grouped together as the same thing. It's different from what you and I are doing. What I did is I basically took my long form magazine life and moved it into audio. They're scripted. I do a 7-episode season. Each episode takes me a month. It's interviewing a whole bunch of people and then writing a script. There's several things I really like about it. One is the audience is there. I think it's got a bigger audience than my books have now. So that's nice. The second is I really like the way it causes me to exercise muscles that I might not use if I'm just writing prose on the page. I should use, but that I might not use. It's writing for the ear. Writing for the ear is different from writing for the eye. And when you're writing for the eye, you should also be writing for the ear, but you can easily forget it. And being forced to write for the ear has had a couple of knock-on effects. One is just to be a little more attuned to how words sound, but the other is to be a little more sensitive to emotion. The ear is a more emotional receptor than the eye. It isn't that you can't generate emotion on the page. Obviously you can. It's just that this medium is a very emotional medium. People pick up just from the sound of a person's voice, how they're feeling. It forces me to think about what the emotional content of what I'm writing is. And sometimes I might forget that or let that slide a bit when I'm writing a book. It's sort of like literary cross-training. I really like the muscles that I build when I do it. And the last thing is, you look like you're all alone there in a room and wherever you are. But with my podcast, I've got this group of people, these producers who really know sound. It's a team sport. And writing books is such an individual sport. This gets back to collaboration. There's just things that you do when you're collaborating, you don't do when you're doing it all by yourself. And I really like that feeling. If the magazine industry had not collapsed, if Vanity Fair or the New York Times Magazine was what it was 20 years ago, I probably wouldn't be doing it. But the magazine industry's collapsed. This new medium has arisen. It enables me to learn new things. And it serves the function that the magazine writing once did for me, which is sort of R&D for the books. Lets me graze, lets me find topics, fiddle around with stuff that I don't want to commit to do a book about, but I am really interested in.
Well, it's called Against the Rules. I have listened to a few of your podcasts and I think they're terrific. And I just will say that that team notion you refer to is essential. The architect of the Money Makes podcast was Will Campion, and he and the other members of the team have been absolutely a joy to work with, and none of it would have happened. And it's just terrific fun, as witnessed by having this conversation with you today. So let me ask you some more general ones. How do you go about allocating and investing your own capital?
I make a few big decisions and leave it be. The only time I would put any money in an individual stock, as opposed to an index or Berkshire Hathaway, which I treated almost as an index, is if I want to just have an excuse to follow the stock. I might buy a little stock, not because I think it's going to go up or down, but because I might write about it. I'll give you an example. I own a little bit, tiny bit, but still a little bit of Tootsie Roll, candy maker in Chicago. And I bought it because when GameStop went crazy, a friend of mine, who I'd once written a piece about when he was a 15-year-old boy and he'd gone into the market and he'd made $700,000 from nothing during the internet bubble, he got in touch with me out of the blue and said, watch Tootsie Roll, it's the next GameStop. I started looking to Tootsie Roll, and it was run by like a 78-year-old woman in Chicago. And I thought, she has no idea what's about to hit her. And if Tootsie Roll is indeed the next GameStop, I want to be on top of it and I will go write about it. Now, Tootsie Roll has not been the next GameStop. It's lost me a little money, but just a little money, but it kept me watching it. So I bought it just to watch it. But that's not really managing my money. With my money, what I do is I think, how much do I want in the stock markets? How much do I want in municipal bonds? And how much do I want in cash? Maybe a little bit in gold or something else. But just like the buckets, I put them in the buckets and mostly in indexes, and I just let it go. So I don't spend a lot of time thinking about it. And the truth is, so far as I can tell, perfectly intelligent way to lead your financial life. And I outperform most hedge fund managers. I don't really spend a lot of time worrying about it.
As you've written with The Premonition, but all your other books, and you've thought about leadership, but also sitting there in the US, it begs the question, can the US ever produce a good president again, or is the nation too fractured?
It's a very hard country to lead right now, and it's not getting easier. You never say never. My problem is I'm kind of constitutionally optimistic. At the same time as you might say, how do we ever get out of this? The tribalism seems worse and worse. The media bubbles seem worse and worse. I don't believe that we're just stuck in this forever. I think that it's going to break like a fever. And there will come a time, probably in response to some existential threat, when the country has to be reunified. I guess the reason I think that is if you ignore the television set and ignore social media, nor Twitter, and you're just out in the world, in the country, drive across country and, I don't know, go to kids' sporting events or go to conferences. Americans are so intertwined in so many ways that Rome could be half Trump and half Berkeley liberals. And if you didn't bring up politics, they'd all get along fine. In fact, they might form fast friendships with these people who they think in theory are the devil. The differences are all on the surface and all salient right now. The similarities aren't being paid attention to. And it's stronger and more interwoven than it appears on the surface. And if it ever really came to it, like if Russia tried to invade, God help them. I just don't think we're that divided a country.
And as you think ahead, is there a shocking or scandalous topic you haven't written on yet but are inclined to?
Cryptocurrency and the world it is wreaking. I was put off by it in the beginning because it just didn't work as money. It was not persuasive as money. And the story in the beginning was this is the new money. And the cryptocurrency people have smartly pivoted and figured that's not the story to tell anymore. If you want to sell this stuff, you have to have a different story. So now it's gold. It's not money, it's gold. It's a store of value. I'm not saying it's not. This is an act of faith. The question is how many people will agree to believe this and how long will they believe it for? And maybe they'll believe it forever. And maybe this is the new gold. It's now reached a scope and a size where it's having all these distortive effects on the world. That really interests me. So that's something I'm flirting with now. My fantasy is I find another sports book or two that excite me as much as Moneyball and The Blind Side excited me. I'm always open to a sports story precisely because it cuts through the divisions in my country. Nobody's really got their guard up when they're reading a sports story, and you can address anything you want to through sports and get a general audience. So that's what I have in mind. Nothing scandalous, unless you think cryptocurrency is scandalous.
You haven't written about alternative assets yet, though, so presumably that's nurturing away. Is it somewhere in your thinking?
You think of me as more of a Wall Street writer than I think of me. Cryptocurrency, I know it's a Wall Street subject, but it's more than a Wall Street subject. If you'd have told me after Liar's Poker that you'd never write a Wall Street book again, I said, you're probably right. Then the financial crisis happens, and how can you avoid that? I mean, I kind of got pulled back into it. And then Flash Boy's story walks in the door, and I think, how can I not write about that? But I'm not looking for Wall Street subjects. It's really true, I guess with the exception of Liar's Poker. It is really true. I do find other subjects, but the Wall Street subjects find me. You tell me when alternative assets is going to come knock on my door and say, hey, you have to pay attention to me. And yeah, maybe.
Any advice for aspiring author listening to this podcast?
When young people who want to be writers ask me, how do you become a writer? I have two answers to the question. One is, are you sure you want to write or do you want to be a writer? If you want to write, then just write and you'll do it because you like doing it. If you want to be a writer, you probably won't. If you want the role or the status or whatever you think it is or the lifestyle, but you don't actually sit down and write with pleasure and interest, it's probably not the best idea. So figure out first that you actually want to write. Then you got to write. Find things that interest you and write about them and see if you can get them in print. But the second thing is, you'll be a much more effective writer if you have lots of experiences in the world. I knew this when I went to work at Salomon Brothers. I just thought the more that I can do that's not just being a writer, the richer the things I write will be for it. Don't just stop at being a writer. Go do stuff. Write at night after you've done your stuff. Just go find experiences, things that interest you, because that will help. It's very hard to just start with a book. I'd start small. I start with little pieces. That's how I started. And then grope your way to if there's a bigger project in you. Pretty simple advice. That's all I got.
And my final question, Michael, is if you could go anywhere in the world and have a book in your lap and a glass of wine, where would it be? What would you be drinking? And what would you be reading?
I'd be reading the book I just started, which is a novel called Horse by Geraldine Brooks. I got sent the galley and I'm mesmerized by it. I know I'd be reading that because that's what I want to be reading right now. I would be in Umbria. I'd be in Umbria in like the town square of Todi with a, do I have to have just one glass of wine? I'd start with a dry white and then move on to a red. So I think that's where I'd be. I loved Italy. I lived in Italy one summer and I never got over it. That's not very adventurous. If you ask me the question, where would I go or be where I've never been? India. I've never been to India. I keep trying to contrive the excuse to go there in some useful way. But town square of Todi in Umbria with more than one glass of wine and Geraldine Brooks' novel.
Well, Michael, it's 37 years since we were at the LSE, and you have thrilled and enthralled and delighted millions. So you need to keep on writing those books, and hopefully they'll make some more films. Are they going to make a film out of Liar's Poker? I mean, surely they should, even now.
So very oddly, The Fifth Risk has a 6-part Netflix series coming out next month. That's the next film. And The Premonition is almost certainly going to happen as a big movie. Liar's Poker, I made the mistake of selling it outright, not optioning it. So I lost the rights entirely to Warner Brothers. And it's just really molded inside of Warner Brothers for 30 years. And they've tried every now and then. What I assume is going to happen with it now, given what's happened in the entertainment world, it's so naturally a TV show rather than a movie. It's so naturally just a series that's set in 1980s Wall Street. Someone will come along and give it a whirl eventually. But I don't know if anybody's doing it right now.
I just want you to know, Michael, that if it happens, I am available.
Are you? We'll cast you. I know exactly who the role you'll play. You'll play John Goodfriend.
Oh, my gosh.
You have to put on 40 or 50 pounds and learn how to smoke a cigar with panache.
Well, Michael, I hope we get together in London when you come on your book tour. So fantastic.
I'd love to do it. I'd absolutely love to do it.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.